Hello, once again, I am Peter Woodbury with Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Today we'll be speaking live with Hugh Newman from his home just a stone's throw from Stonehenge. He is a self-declared megalithomaniac, a researcher of ancient mysteries, a frequent speaker here at the Edgar Cayce Center, and also a researcher of the giants of North America. So join me in this conversation with Mr. Hugh Newman. So Hugh, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, that's great to be here.
Yeah, and are you coming to us from England? Are you in?
Yeah, I'm currently in England, currently at home. I live surprisingly close to Stonehenge.
So, okay.
In the heartland of southern England on Salisbury Plain.
Oh, okay. Is that by chance that you live so close to Stonehenge?
Oh, no, I made it that way. It was purely intentional.
Do they have a picture of you at Stonehenge, like a warning to all the staff? You know, if you see this man climbing fences.
I'm sure in the near future that there might be, yeah. So let's wait and see.
Now, do you lead tours of Stonehenge, or do you do any ceremonies there?
Yeah, we do a bit of all that kind of stuff. We do regular trips there. We run tours. We run the Megalithomania Conference in Glastonbury, but we bring tour groups to there. We have people stay here. We just had Michael Tellinger here. He's like a well-known kind of author and explorer. He's been here for a few days. It's kind of a nice little base.
That's great. It's kind of like I live 10 blocks from the ARE, so we kind of share that in common.
Yeah, that's useful.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested? I mean, you're a self-declared megalithomaniac. How did that get started?
That's correct. Yeah, megalithomaniac. That is exactly what I am. But this really, we'll just give a bit of background. That name comes from the book Megalithomania by John Michel that came out in 1982. Uh-huh. It was about artists, antiquarians, archaeologists getting excited and blown away and obsessive about the big stone monuments. And mm-hmm. that's really why we set up the conference of the same name back in 2006. To bridge this gap between academia and the alternative world, to explore these mysteries.
Yeah.
And I'm just that. That's just, you know, I'm just a megalithomaniac. I'm constantly exploring, traveling as much as possible, writing, making videos, everything else about these particular sites. And in recent years, it's been a lot of revelations, a few new discoveries, just by, you know, going the extra mile to actually spend more time at these sites, look in places you're not supposed to look, mm-hmm. and take it from that perspective. But also I'm kind of interested in other things. There's like mainly landscape mysteries. There's the crop circles, because mm-hmm. I live right in the heart of the crop where the crop circles appear. I've been studying those for 20 or more years.
Yeah.
And a few other things, you know, I've written books about the giant skeletons of North America with Jim Vieira, who spoke at your event last year, mm-hmm. I believe. There's all these different aspects kind of blend into one, constant research of the ancient landscape.
Yeah. And how did that start for you? Do you remember, like, what did you read a book, or did you watch a show? How did that get sparked for you?
Well, when I was a kid, my mum used to subscribe to a magazine called The Unexplained, which came every month or every few weeks, and mm-hmm. it's like a 14 kind of magazine. Everything you could, all the unexplained kind of X-Files type stuff, and I was constantly reading that. It was blowing my mind. Mm-hmm. And then when I was young, I was in my early 20s, I guess. I was quite interested in all the alien stuff, and then the UFOs and such mysteries. And then I visited a crop circle with my brother, and it just blew us away.
How old were you?
I was in my early 20s. Oh. I can't remember exactly. And it was quite a revelation to sort of see these mysteries in the fields occurring in my own country. So we started investigating it thoroughly.
Yeah.
And then that kind of got me into the ancient mysteries and the ancient landscape, because that's where all the crop circles are. They're always near ancient sites. Uh-huh. Kind of threw me into that world, you know, looking at the geometry, the ancient metrology, and the mysteries and earth energies and things like this.
What are your thoughts about the crop circles? Like, what are they about, or what are they communicating?
Well, they're one of the strangest phenomena to happen on the planet ever, in mm-hmm. my opinion. And for those that are listening, if they think it's just a bunch of blokes with planks after the pub having fun.
I don't think we have many of those watching our shows.
but that's good. Thank you. Good. And, you know, the thing is, there's a prehistory of crop circles, which, mm-hmm. which really interests me. That if you look into historical record, you find references to them go back hundreds, possibly thousands of years. And that fascinates me. Yeah. And so that, to me, that gives it clarity, and it gives it a reality that they're not all man-made, just to clear that up once and for all. So if that is the case, then what on earth are they? That's what you've got to ask. And mm-hmm. the fact you're finding very intricate geometry, you're finding incredibly sophisticated number systems, or, you know, ancient metrology numbers even, you're finding you know, optical illusions, you're finding the way they are placed in the landscape in relation to each other and to ancient sites. They're encoding very strange and possibly very high level information. And, mm-hmm. and in fact, some of the geometry, even in the earlier circles back in the 1980s, even though it looked quite simple, they were encoding how to square the circle, which has been the bane of geometers for years, mm-hmm. decades, hundreds of years. And so there's the fact that you're finding that in quite simple constructions of these circles. Then the more complicated ones, you're finding other things, other extremely sophisticated geometry systems that haven't been even thought about by modern humans. Mm-hmm. It's mind-blowing. So if it is a communication, it's a very gentle and a very long-term communication with whoever's making them. It could mm-hmm. be Gaia, it could be like the Earth, it could be the elemental realm, the fairies, the sprites, the mm-hmm. elves, all this kind of stuff, which is, you know, I believe is a reality, and it's still mm-hmm. traditions of those are still strong, and they're always connected with these kind of phenomena. Or it could be, you know, just alien intelligences from other star systems or even other dimensions. And so we have to kind of, you know, carefully consider this. But I think fundamentally it's just a case of observing them, appreciating them, and just, you know, allowing them into your life mm-hmm. is the first step. You don't mm-hmm. have to understand them all, you don't have to get it, you don't have to kind of work out all this geometry, the metrology, or the mathematics. You can just appreciate them for their divine geometrical beauty. I think that is the key. That is the key to like true communication, whether it just be with, you know, a design, or whether it be an actual language. So I think, you know, as we know, as you know, people at the ARE know, you know, the fundamental universal language that stretches through all time and space is mathematics and geometry.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they come in these forms does suggest that it's a communication through time, space, and dimensions, and it's always the same. You can't deny it's always the same. Everyone can read it the same way.
Yes, and it seems that it communicates with something deeper than your conscious mind. There's like an unconscious kind of triggering.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think that's why it's just a case of appreciate them. Don't dismiss them. Don't throw them out. Don't dismiss them as hoaxes. Just appreciate them, because I think there's something there.
Yeah.
And nowadays you have to decipher which ones are man-made and hoaxes.
Yeah.
Which ones are not. But even the man-made ones are remarkable, and there's some remarkable people constructing them.
Now, has anybody ever happened upon kind of a non-man-made one happening? Has anyone ever experienced whatever is going on that creates these?
Yeah, there's a couple of accounts. One of them was filmed in 1996 at Oliver's Castle in Wiltshire, and actually saw these three or four balls of light, you know, about this size, moving around in a circle and forming a crop circle, like crop flattening as they move around in a few seconds. Friend Gary King witnessed the 777 formation in 2007. He was filming this field all night with some other people, and there was a huge flash of light. And then when eventually the sun rose, there was this massive crop circle there. So there's things like this. There's been eyewitness accounts. There's been balls of light have been filmed and recorded. There's been people who believe they've created them with intentions with their own minds. It's definitely one of those unusual, unexplained phenomena, which is still unexplained.
One of my favorite kind of New Age humorous stories was John Van Auken led a tour to England, and he was called and told there was a crop circle that had just appeared. And so the tour group went, but it was a wheat crop circle. And so someone on the tour said, "Well, I'm gluten intolerant. Could we find a corn crop circle or barley?" I always love that story.
That's a good one. I like that. It's a good anecdote or slash joke.
Yeah. But you got to have a sense of humor in the new age.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Continuing with the... So what was the first megalith that you visited? I assume you've been to the pyramids and to Machu Picchu and all these places.
Yeah, I get around a bit. Yeah, that's for sure. Do a lot of traveling. But yeah, the first megalith I really visited that I can remember was probably local ones to where I was from in Cambridge, because there are a few scattered around there. But I know that, for instance, which is quite a strange story, that my mum and dad, when my mum was pregnant with me, they drove around in the camper van to all the megalithic sites for some reason. And one morning they woke up next to Silbury Hill because I was kicking so hard. They pulled over to get a night's sleep. They woke up next to Silbury Hill, right in the heart of the Avebury landscape. So I don't know if you can call that the first megalithic site I went to, but
I see.
But certainly. So
you share that with your parents. So your parents were interested in ancient cultures and that.
I think they were a little bit, yeah, especially my mum. She's very interested in the alternative way of thinking. She's been doing yoga for 40 years and been a vegetarian for 30 years. These alternative ways of living. So that was a useful kind of upbringing in that respect.
Have you ever had any, ever done a past life regression or had dreams where you see yourself in the past as part of these structures or anything with that?
Not so much, but I'm sure if I come to the ARE, that might happen to me. We'll see.
We have this past life Kool-Aid that you can drink, and you'll see all kinds of things.
I've had people tell me that I've been certain things in past lives.
But none of it resonates so much yet.
Not quite yet. We'll see.
Oh, good. It's always nice to meet someone in the new age who's a little bit skeptical. That's kind of nice. It's refreshing. Now, earlier you mentioned the giants that you and another fellow had researched. You know, Edgar Cayce gave readings about those people. Any more thoughts about that? About what was going on then that people were so tall?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, we mentioned Edgar Cayce in our book. It's quite a large chunk of it in a couple of chapters. We look at mystics and alternative thinkers, and also in the final chapter, because he was talking about not only the giants of Atlantis and things like this, he was also talking about giants in North America, and that really compelled us, because we didn't realize some of his more obscure readings talk about that. And that actually correlates strangely closely with the discoveries we've made. So Vieira, who's my co-author, is very much into Edgar Cayce. He's a real follower, and I've been aware of the old Edgar Cayce thing for many, many years. So to find that correlation, we found quite interesting. And I'll be bringing that up at the conference when why that is quite important. The fact that he was picking up on this really before it was known about publicly, that there were these discoveries being made. They were being made at the time Edgar Cayce was around doing these readings, strangely, and before that and after that. And so, there's so many accounts, actual physical accounts of giant skeletons and bones being dug up across the whole of North America. We've got something like 1,500 accounts, 1,500. We only featured 250 in the book, so we could squeeze into 400 pages. And it's just a remarkable cover-up, the way it's all been covered up so meticulously since they were being discovered right up until the present day. And it's all very subtle. It's all very carefully covered up and ridiculed. But the fact that we're having a whole period of human history deleted from the record is something that bugged me and Jim very much. And so we decided to put this book together. While we were doing the book, we got offered to do a TV show for History Channel. So we did a 6-part show called Search for the Lost Giants, which unfortunately got cancelled after 6 shows. But we're looking at doing some more on this subject, because we feel it's a very important subject. And we've spread that around the world a bit. We're now working on a book about the British giants and finding some remarkable things here. And again, it's been a cover-up. And so this is the issue we have really with it. When something's covered up so meticulously and all the legends state this is a reality, and then all the discoveries in the historical record, we're talking about academic journals, mm-hmm. Smithsonian's own annual reports, even though they then covered it up, has 17 accounts of between 7 and 8 foot tall skeletons. I mean, that's the lower range of the ones we're dealing with. We have up to 14 or 18 feet tall, mm-hmm. Some of the accounts. And so it's just one of these interesting facets of the ancient mysteries, because they're always connected with the megalithic sites, with the construction of the megalithic sites, the earthworks, the hill forts, and they always built in what are called high places. Mm-hmm. We even get the same stories in the Bible, in the Old Testament, and things like this, mm-hmm. talking about these biblical giants. So it's a genuine phenomenon there, a genuine part of history that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
And we're part of that process.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're invested in the untold stories, kind of the untold parts of history, and then the kind of trying to help people understand the purposes of the megalithic structures and kind of what or the crop circles and kind of what they're offering us at this time. Do you have more thoughts about that? I mean, here at the ARE, we're very Casey gave readings about the transition into this new age and a kind of awakening. What do you see in your work that's part of, is there something that you think human consciousness is kind of ready to awaken to, or is important to awaken to?
Yes, yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I think just, when I'm taking it from the perspective of just the research I've been doing, mm-hmm. Just with these giants, for example, I mean, the fact that it's been so meticulously covered up is quite enlightening and quite shocking, and people can't handle it when you tell them this and you show them all the evidence. It's almost like, well, that can't be true because I was taught that at school. I have not seen that on TV.
Yeah.
How can that be? And so once you start going down the rabbit hole, you keep going further and you keep going further, and more things come up, stranger things come up. And this is the case with things like this. The crop circles are another one. They really are potentially, we're always looking for, how do we communicate with otherworldly beings? Mm-hmm. Why aren't they getting back to us? And they are. They have been for 100 years. Mm-hmm. They've been doing it in the fields of England, for mm-hmm. God's sake. And so the fact you've got this, is, if people just look a bit deeper, they go beyond, but underneath what the media are telling us, underneath, start digging into the alternative records, even the academic records that have been squashed under and just in dusty old museums and libraries, you start uncovering things. And a combination with exploring and traveling, from my perspective, it's amazing what you can discover, if you just push past what is on the internet, especially what other people have written about in the last 20 or 30 years. You go beyond that. You look into the old records, the old books. You go and look to the sites yourselves. You get your own photos. You do your own digging and things like this. That's when it all changes. But so many people, like 99% of researchers and writers, are just saying what other people have said, and it becomes a frustrating kind of journey when you're looking for a deeper understanding. Yeah. And I think I've been involved in the alternative kind of scene for a while, the New Age scene, the health. I used to study nutrition and things mm-hmm. like this, naturopathic nutrition and body work, healing modalities, and so forth. So I'm very aware of that, and the fact that one of the other aspects worth mentioning here, that which is very important, is this idea of earth energies. Now, it sounds like a kind of new agey mm-hmm. idea about megalithic sites, but actually there's some really good science done on that now by people like John Burke. Kaj Helberger wrote the book Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. Mm-hmm. Philip Callahan in the 70s and 80s, and other researchers realizing, now proven scientifically, that these ancient sites manipulated natural earth energy currents. And you can actually, if you go to the sites now and you place some seeds there or grains, it'll charge them up in a certain way. So when you go and plant the grains and seeds, you get a much higher yield, a better quality crop, and more abundant food. So this was one of the secrets of the ancients. But the same energy, this sort of natural, this natural magnetic telluric energy, would affect your consciousness. Mm-hmm. give you altered states and visionary experiences. And so we have to, that is coming to light now, that these ancient sites and these ancient people had a very high understanding of, of very, very advanced technology, but not the way we see technology today. It was an earthly nature technology. This is something I really emphasize in all my talks and my writings and writing things like this, because that's something that could change the world, because it could replace, you know, people could understand how this works. It could replace the whole GM crop problem. It could replace all, you know, any problems of famine, starvation, and foods not growing properly and things like this. So, there's a lot going on in this current paradigm that needs more attention.
Yeah, and there's plenty of Casey readings that would support what you just said. Because I remember I led a tour to Guatemala, and Casey talked about the fire stones, these stones that had been charged with physical and spiritual energies, where he actually described angelic beings would work with people that were, in a way, purifying on these stones. And we did a ceremony there. And, you know, I'm, as much as I do this kind of stuff, I'm not an energy sense guy. I don't walk in places and pick up stuff. So I'm kind of energy dense. But that experience really felt profound for me, that just the clearing or whatever it was. Like, I feel that I shifted something in that energy field, and for the better, in a positive way.
Yeah, and I agree. I think these sites, you know, that they're designed from a very high level perspective. They're like, they're choosing places to put them on the earth, which are power spots, which are potentially portals. They're kind of something special and liminal kind of space, like a sacred, sanctified space naturally. And then they build upon that and then work around that. And then they sort of bring it in a certain way. And then you have the human interaction with it, and it can have a profound effect. And it can affect, you know, spread across the planet, spread through consciousness. And I think that there's a reality to all these ceremonies and tribal societies and the way they operate. It's something in it that science is starting to catch up with.
And it seems that, I mean, like you're saying, the repression of this kind of information, at least in the United States, there seems to be a bit of an opening, because I've seen, I think it's just in the last few months, that the U.S. government has acknowledged their program on aliens, that they were studying that, and they've allowed some of the video and some of the audio and some of the people, the military people, to talk about it, which is a big shift, because you used to have, you were sworn to not be, after you left the military, never to talk about any of these experiences. So it seems that, I guess it's reached critical mass, that they're feeling that they have to in some way begin to discuss that.
Yeah, I think it's, I think there's that their reasoning for not bringing it out to the public is there'll be a worldwide panic. And there might well be. So we have to kind of, you know, be aware that could be the case.
What was that show that they had, a radio show back when people believed Orson Welles did, the aliens were landing and everybody went crazy?
I mean, you could imagine there would be a bit of a panic, and it would change people's realities overnight. And so you can understand, I can understand that there's a reason for that, why they cover certain things up, but not others, obviously. But that, you know, I think, I would be slightly concerned if they suddenly announced, yes, aliens are here, deal with it. You know, you've got to, like, what? You know, oh, they're invisible, they're around you every day. What? so you've got to, like, you know, consider that as well.
Break people in slowly.
Yeah,
have Steven Spielberg make a movie or two, and people softened up.
Yeah, people used to it, and then there's nice aliens as well. So hopefully.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, I know that you know, Edgar Cayce, when he gave his readings, he would talk about people's past lifetimes, and twice he made reference to the person being around where there was apparently a visitation from other worlds, but there was no follow up. That, you know, it's like, even now you think Edgar Cayce's giving this stuff, and it was almost like you wonder, it must have been that this was too far out there. Like, they were dealing with reincarnation, they were dealing with astrology. They said, oh, we're not going to go into aliens. So they didn't, it was mentioned twice. And as you read it, you go, God, why didn't they follow up? But I think it's like you're saying, you know, it's difficult to shift paradigms, and history is not kind to the paradigm shifters. And so I think that's kind of what you've been up against is you're trying to talk about aliens and you're trying to talk about crop circles and giants. You know, it's almost like ego, like, oh, we're going to have to rewrite our history books, and it's easier not to rewrite the history books, so let's just suppress you instead of having to shift paradigms.
Yeah. I think that's the nature of, you know, uncovering uncomfortable truths, yeah. You know. And to be honest with you, I mean, you look around the world today, I mean, with all the traveling I've been doing, you see remnants of lost civilizations in places where it's not being recorded mm-hmm. that anyone was even there. And that blows me away. It's a bit like the way that the giants or the aliens are kind of kept quiet. Mm-hmm. And the reasoning for that I find very strange. I mean, I've just been to Italy, for instance. I've been traveling in Sardinia, the Mediterranean. And there's a whole megalithic culture there that goes way back before the Romans, before the Etruscans. And it's remarkable. And you get the same kind of megalithic technologies you do in ancient Peru, like the massive polygonal walls there. Mm-hmm. And there's literally nothing about it has been written mm-hmm. or researched, apart from one person I know and one person in Italy, and someone, an antiquarian in the mid-1800s. That's it. Mm-hmm. And you're like, hang on a sec, this is like stunning. We've been to all these sites, they're mind-blowing. So it's up to individuals to kind of, you know, push forward with things and yeah. you know, bring things out to the public to you know, wake them up to what's just around them, yes. what's beneath their feet.
And you know, I have great respect for science. You know, I think that it's a powerful tool. But sometimes you get almost fundamentalist scientists that don't want to go with the information. They want to go, or with the data, they want to go with their bias. You know, if you look at, like, you know, the thing about how the pyramids were built, to think that people, slaves or whatever, were lifting these 100-ton stones, what is it, 30 stories up in the air, that they were doing that with pulleys, it defies logic. I mean, science could find some other possible reason for that, but just the one that seems to be traditional just doesn't seem to make any sense.
Well, that's the issue, I think. I mean, nowadays, everyone has noticed this, that the only voice of ancient sites is archaeologists mm-hmm. for some reason. Why is it only archaeologists who are the sole voice speaking on behalf of Stonehenge, the pyramids, Machu Picchu, and so on and so forth? Mm-hmm. Where are the geomancers, the dowsers? Where are the visionaries, the, mm-hmm. the psychics? Where are the people with all these different disciplines, the yes. people who study sacred geometry, archaeoacoustics, other things like this? Why is the only voice and the only voice people accept yeah. in the media and in the mainstream, all archaeologists do is dig things up and record what's there? That's it. I mean, no disrespect to them. They do really hard work.
Yes.
They do really struggling, hard work in the rain, bad hours, the blistering sun.
Right.
Ridiculous. And I respect them for the amazing work that many of them do. But for them to be the sole voice of the megalithic sites
yes.
is
That's
very
a great point.
Unbalanced. And it's a sign of what's wrong with society, the way science is the only voice of reality.
Yeah.
It's just not correct. And I think this is, the balance is all wrong. And yes. I think that's what's slowly, very slowly changing. And this is the whole, you know, this whole awakening that's potentially yeah. taking place. This is part of, you know, shifting that balance. I mean, just to put it, you know, simple layman's, with this conference we do, Megalithomania, we deliberately invite academics and archaeologists to come and speak at our conference. And we invite the extremely out there stuff as well, because yeah. everything's, you know, we filter them to make sure they're not complete nutters and things like this, you know, they're sane and stuff, but you know, we bring it together, and that creates this amazing energy, and like everyone's on an equal plateau, at equal kind of standing, and to discuss the sites, you know, because I know people who spent more years researching megalithic sites and they're not archaeologists, and archaeologists have.
Yeah.
And yet they become the sole voice. So this is frustrating. This is why I sort of hark back to the 1800s. And there's an era of antiquarians, they're called, where these people like William Stukeley, John Aubrey, George Dennis, when you're looking at ancient Italy, and people like this, were out there exploring, writing about sites, illustrating, mapping them, digging a little bit, and all this kind of stuff. Because they just did it. And they paid for it themselves. They had no funding, did it all off their own back, loved it and made it their life, and yet they get dismissed
Yes.
Someone who's done one archaeology degree and has dug two sites in their life, you know. And so this is my point. This is where I get frustrated. Well,
it's an excellent point, because you could, it's like when you have a laboratory, the people that administer the experiment, they aren't the ones that interpret the data. You know, it's like the archaeologists create data, and that data becomes open to interpretation in lots of disciplines. And so what you're saying is that the data gatherers become the interpreters, which wouldn't hold water in any other field.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is, you know, in many of the fields I've been looking into and things like this, it's like, I mean, you look at people like Michael Crimo, who got ridiculed, and people he knows who find these millions of year old, billions of year old human fossils and things like this, and get completely discredited, lose all their kind of university, you know, places and things like this. And so this is what happens. And it's like, hang on a sec, it's all just gone a bit wrong, really.
Yes.
And so I get frustrated when people say, oh, well, you're not an academic, how can you possibly comment on Stonehenge? I said, well, it's my life. You know, I'm an antiquarian. This is what I love. You know, this is what I do. And I think this is where, you know, things like the place like the ARE and groups I'm involved with, it's really useful, you know, that you get different disciplines coming in and discussing.
Yeah. Well, it's a platform, and your platform is reaching more and more people. It's resonating with folks. Well, the time has kind of flown by, but is there anything you'd like to cover, anything we haven't covered you'd like to speak to? I know you'll be back again here soon at the Ancient Mysteries Conference. Anything you'd like to close with that we haven't covered?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things I could get into. but yeah, no, I think it's just a case of, you know, when it comes to ancient sites, I think I do encourage people, if they can, go and visit some. If you're in America, there's a surprising amount of ancient sites there. Mm-hmm. In New England, this is where Jim Vieira lives, hundreds of megalithic sites. There's Gungi Wamp, there's America Stonehenge, there's North Salem Dolmen, New York State. Going to the Mississippi, up to the Ohio Valley, got all the Mao culture sites, the amazing museums and artifacts that have been discovered. You go to California, the shell mounds, there's all the petroglyph sites in Nevada and Arizona. And I think if you want to get a sense of the ancient sites, you have to try and go to them, even if they're local. And if people want to come to England, get in touch with me, I'll take you to Stonehenge, we can walk there.
You can literally walk there from your house.
Literally walk there, yeah. And so it's like, you know, this is, you know, I think it's important, and I encourage people to do that, whatever position you're in financially or whatever, you know, anything, just make a little bit of effort, just go out for a weekend, you know, and even if you have to go camping.
Yeah.
And I think, well, you know, you get a really different sense of like how the ancients would have lived when you're out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
You sit inside this stone circle or this petroglyph site, the sun sets, the stars come out, and you suddenly realize that's how the ancients were living. They were observing the stars. That was their TV, that was their internet. And so, you know, you can imagine how different it was and how clear the mind is, and how, you know, you're completely present and your intuition is at a heightened level. And I think that's important, you know, just to get to ancient sites and to feel the energies and to, you know, touch the stones. And I encourage people to do that, whether it's come and join me here or anywhere, or you go out, you know, with group members, little groups of the ARE, highly recommend it.
Oh, great. Good. Well, that's a great point to end on. Well, I've enjoyed our conversation. We could have gone on for much longer, but thank you for your time, and I hope I get to see you next time you're here.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Have a good rest of your day.